All right, we're live. We got a new setup. I mean, it's the exact same space, but I pushed the camera back and now you can see more of the background and you can see the table. And I just set this all up and I have this picture in the background, which has a bunch of significance, which I'll get into. But now that it's all set up and I was ready to record, I finally pulled the mic down and it's just could not be more in front of the photo that I was trying to display. So we're gonna make do, because I'd like to record now. And part of why I want to record now is because this has been the craziest 2-ish months of my entire life, and it's not even close. It's absolutely bananas, these sequences that are so beyond anything that I've experienced before, emotionally, physically, spiritually. There's so much shit happening. And I was thinking to myself for the last 2 months, like, God, how amazing it would be to be able to talk about these things that have been happening with the people that are listening, you, or watching, knowing the context of everything that's happened before. Because there's so much stuff happening like every day that is crazy, but so much crazier if you know everything that's already happened. So I'm just going to tell it all from the beginning, from the moment this all started happening. And I recorded an episode about a month ago and didn't put it out because I didn't do it. But I'm going to release that episode now and then pick up, because that's in the old setup, and then I'm going to pick up in this new setup when that episode finishes. But it's all tied together, and it all started with this trip when I went home. So, God, I feel so lucky to be able to have a place where I can talk about this stuff with you. And it's like, God, I'm just so fucking lucky. And so thank you for listening. And I know it's been a couple of months, but I can explain. I can explain why it has taken me so long. So here we go. I remember in like 6th or 7th grade, there was a guy in my class named Danny who figured out how to do that thing. It sounds like a raindrop with your mouth and tongue. Dude, I remember seeing him do that and thinking to myself, like, if that was in my arsenal of capabilities as a human, everything would be all right. Felt the same way about twirling pencils, this thing. Spent literally years perfecting this. I wonder what the things are now that I think that if I had that or was able to do that, then everything would be okay. I was certainly feeling it today. I just got back from the beach. I've been doing night meditations on the beach, and the moon's out, and it's like just quiet, and it's just the sound of the waves, and oh man, it just fucking hits. And it was a full moon tonight, and I one of the main like head loops that I get into, thought loops, is I'll see somebody who's more successful than me, and then I'll start feeling bad about my current situation despite feeling great about it before I started thinking about this other person who is seemingly more successful in these aspects that I've defined as essential to happiness. Like, I'll go from having like a totally fantastic day, and then I'll go on Instagram and see somebody who got 100,000 likes on a video, and I'll be like, you know, that's what I need. If I had that. But I know that's not the case. And I know that there's nothing that will come externally that will permanently make me feel okay internally. It's all like temporary highs. Everything external is some sort of temporary relief or temporary fix for an internal issue that isn't really an issue until I start thinking, you know, I feel really good until I start thinking about other people that get more likes on Instagram. or whatever. But as I was sitting on the beach, I was like, you know, for the first time in a while, I was like thinking of these comedians and podcasters and people that are in the same spaces as me and just feeling like good about them, like about consuming their content. Like I felt, I was just appreciating and laughing and enjoying their stuff instead of fucking feeling bad about myself. And, you know, that's the experience. Whatever you feel about, whether it's something you're thinking about externally or internally, whatever you feel is what your experience is. So if I feel jealous or not enough or unworthy because of something external or internal, that's what my reality is right now, is the feeling of unworthiness. And if I look at somebody who has everything that I think that I want and I just feel love for them, what my experience is love and appreciation and whatever the feeling that I have inside is. And so I was like, it felt like my ego was battling with my current self or more worthy self or whatever it is. It felt like there was a pull to worry and a pull to love, and I just let go a little more of the worry and leaned in a little more to the love, and it felt good, man. Like, how lucky I am to have the main issue in my life at that moment be somebody is more successful than me in terms of likes on Instagram. I'm sitting on a beach meditating in California for free. Everything's fine. Part of why I felt this shift in comparisons and just in life in general is I went home back to Seattle for 2 weeks and I just got back, and it was such a transformative trip for so many reasons. I think it's going to span multiple episodes of this podcast, but for this episode, I'm going to start with the very first night that I got back. So we've been doing this thing where, you know, I used to do all my planning through my mom, and then I found out, you know, she gets very stressed when she knows that people are coming and she has to plan and do a bunch of shit to get ready. And so I've started just coming home and surprising her. And my dad doesn't, you know, he doesn't do anything to prepare for me coming home. So whenever I come home, it's just like, hey, what's up? But my mom needs to get everything perfect. And I don't need everything perfect. I just want to see them. So I try to show up having caused as little stress as possible for my mom. So I surprised her and I coordinated with my dad, and he picked me up from the ferry, and we got some food. My mom came back, we were in the backyard, and I hid. And my dad, when she got home from work, my dad went out to the car and brought her to the backyard and was like, look, I got you food. And she was immediately like, all right, something's up. She said afterwards, like, that was a pretty clear giveaway, because he rarely does that. But eventually I came out and surprised her. And it's just always, you know, it's just a great feeling to be able to do that. So it was probably like 7 o'clock, and we sat down and we chatted until 2 or maybe 3 in the morning. And this chat was so insane. It started off, I mean, we, you know, with my family at this point, we talk about everything. It's a very open line of communication. And we were just diving into hypotheticals that my mom was playing in her head about the molestation and things that she could have done differently. I think a lot of parents feel this way when they find out that their kid was molested, or just, you know, anyone thinks of all the different things that they could have done. Things they could have done differently to make things better or less extreme. And as you know, a large part of this podcast is dedicated to hypotheticals. And I happen to have played out a lot of hypotheticals myself with regards to that scenario. We were like, all right, let's play them out. Let's see what this would have been like. And the first one that we looked at was, what would have happened if we had not gone to trial? because the trial was super traumatizing, and my parents and I know now the impact that this had on me and the toll that it took. And because I told my mom first, she had the opportunity to not tell anyone else. And I made her promise not to tell my dad because I thought that my dad would fight the guy who molested me, and I thought that my dad would lose and potentially die. So I made her promise not to tell anyone. So if she had not told anyone and she had just kept it between us, yes, it's true that we wouldn't have gone to trial. But think of all the kids who would have been exposed to this guy. Just because I don't go over there anymore doesn't mean that he's going to stop molesting kids. But when you take somebody to trial for something like this, you automatically, they, even if they don't get convicted, it's their, the risk for them is now so much greater if they get caught. So he has this huge deterrent now for continuing to molest kids. So right away, there's a super positive part of this hypothetical. Secondly, and this is one thing that we realized during this conversation, is that if we didn't go to trial, like as traumatizing as the trial was, it forced me to tell my entire story as best I could remember in an environment that was insanely intense in front of the guy who molested me. And as fucked up as that was, it did show me that I can talk about this and survive. I can share my story and I will be okay. There are a lot of more beneficial ways to have that experience than with the trial, but the trial allowed me to have that realization. And without the trial, I don't think I ever would have done stand-up. Because without the trial, I don't know if I would have thought to myself, like, I could get on stage and talk about this in front of a bunch of people. But I had already done that with the trial. And not saying that the trial is necessary for you to speak up and tell your whole story, but it did force me to do that. And if I didn't do stand-up, then I never would have started the podcast. I never would have gone to therapy. I never would have healed, potentially. So all the harm that you theoretically would have prevented by not telling my dad, not going to trial, ultimately would have led me down a completely different path that probably would have resulted in me just continuing to bottle up the emotions that I had from this experience, these experiences, and just not healed. I mean, I don't know if I would have ever said anything other than just, you know, telling my mom had it not been for the trial. So right away, we have two really positive examples of things that happened that may not have happened if things had happened differently. So the next thing my mom said was she wishes that she had noticed sooner. She wishes that she had picked up on the subtle cues that I was giving that something was wrong, that in retrospect, okay, these are things that, you know, maybe you could have picked up on, but without knowing that I was being molested, it would have been very difficult to have figured that out. But regardless, she still was holding on to some guilt about not having noticed earlier. So we started playing with hypotheticals of what would have happened if she had noticed sooner. And the first thing that came to mind for me was, like, I wasn't ready to talk about what had happened until my mom asked me. I don't think. Even if she had suspected something was going on and she had asked me, I think I would have denied it. I didn't know what would happen if I spoke up, but I was fairly certain that it wouldn't be great for Jamie. Probably we wouldn't be able to be friends anymore. I mean, there's a lot of things that had to happen in order for me to get to the point where I was able to speak about what happened. And if my mom had noticed sooner, maybe she would have suspected something, and then just, even if I denied it, she could have pulled me out of the situation, and, you know, I'd never go to Jim's house again and I don't get molested anymore. Maybe I go get molested by somebody else, but probably I never heal. So we were just battling hypotheticals with hypotheticals, attempting to prove that what happened in reality was ideal. And it's going well so far. And eventually, we got to this one point. So the last time that I was over at Jamie's house, I got into a fight with Jamie and one of our other friends. And we were all wrestling. And there was a point where Jamie, like, jumped on top of my rib cage. And our other friend was, like, pantsing me. not like in a sexual way, but at that time, that was just something that we all did. And Jamie's dad, who I called Jim, was sitting on the couch watching this whole thing going on. And I was like visibly distraught and they wouldn't get off me. I was yelling, stop. And eventually I got them off me and I was just started crying and I went and called my mom. And as I was going to call my mom, Jim started pleading like, hey, Sebastian, like, please don't call your mom. Like, don't go now. Like, it's okay. The boys were just messing around, yada, yada. But I was done. I was pissed. I mean, a big part of why I hadn't spoken up until this point was because of how much I valued my friendship with Jamie. And it felt like this was a moment where I was kind of like, fuck you, dude. I'm not going to just continue putting up with this molestation because I don't value you as much as a friend right now. And Jim knows that I've never like left in tears before. So he's like really scared because this is also like a month or two after I told him to stop. The only time that I ever said, please stop, during the molestation while he was doing it. And he did stop, but then he continued on other times. So he's like realizing this is like peak, you know, this is dangerous for him now. Like I am a massive risk to his life and future potential ability to molest kids, his ability to molest me. I am like hugely dangerous to this guy now, more than ever. So my mom came to pick me up and I was just not having it from Jim. And I went out to the car and he tried to come out after us. And I just said, Mom, drive, like take me home. And she did, and I was crying in the car, and I didn't leave the house that day thinking that I was going to tell anyone about what happened. It was just such an emotional overload. But anyway, so we drove home, and when we got back, we were sitting in the car in the driveway, and my mom didn't know what had happened. She thought that there was some sort of a fight between me and Jamie and our friend, and she didn't think that anything had happened with Jim. She had no reason to think that. And what my dad told me and my mom was that, because we stayed in the driveway for, I don't know, 30 minutes or an hour. And apparently Jim called our home phone after he figured we had gotten back. And he called and my dad picked up. And he was apologizing to my dad like profusely, like, I'm so sorry, Bob. I'm so sorry that this happened. It was, the boys were just messing around. And my dad has no idea what he's talking about. So he's like, yeah, I mean, no worries, Jim. It's all good. Just kids will be kids. Don't sweat it. You know, my dad's like consoling the pedophile, trying to make him feel okay. Obviously not knowing what's going on. But Jim was super worried and trying to get ahead of what could potentially come up. And he wasn't able to get a hold of me or my mom. So my dad said that that was the conversation that they had, and my mom and I didn't know. And so we eventually went inside, and basically like 2 days later, my mom and I were in the kitchen. And at the time, my dad worked in Seattle, and he would commute over from Bainbridge. He would take the ferry over, and sometimes he would stay in the office and sleep in the office at night because the commute was long and he had, you know, was busy with stuff. So it was the middle of the day. My mom and I were in the kitchen, and I heard somebody coming up the steps to our front door. And I went to the top of the stairs, and I heard a knock. And without seeing who it was, the door just opened. Without waiting for us to come open the door was unlocked, and Jim walked into the house. And I ran to my room, and I remember my heart was pounding, and I was so scared because I know what he knows and he knows what I know, but you know, my mom doesn't know any of this yet. And so I don't know what he's here to do. I assume he's just trying to, you know, apologize or whatever. And, but it was just scary because he had broken basically into our house, and that was like the safe zone. I never got molested in my house by Jim. It was always at his house, but here he is invading the space of our home. So I ran to my room and I put my back against the door, and my mom eventually came and knocked on the door, and she said, hey, you know, Jim's here. He wants to talk to you and apologize. Do you want to talk to him? And I said, no. So my mom went back out, and from my perspective, I was just, you know, with my back against the door, just waiting. And I don't know how long this went on for, but eventually Jim left and my mom came and said, hey, he's gone. it's okay, you can come out. So up until this point, I haven't really known what happened with Jim and my mom and the conversation that they had. But during this conversation that me and my mom and my dad were having in the backyard around the table, I heard her describe the situation. And basically, she figured in that moment that something was up. Because why am I running away from Jamie's dad? Why, if I'm mad at Jamie, why am I running away from his dad? And she said that she started asking him questions, not in like an accusatory way, but she was like, okay, like did something happen? And he was like, yeah, the boys were just roughhousing. And she was like, okay, did anything inappropriate happen? Without saying, did you do anything inappropriate? She just said, did anything inappropriate happen? And he was like, they were inappropriate with me. Spoken like a true pedophile, you know? The kids were doing it to me. They were asking for it. And this is one of the things that my mom was saying. She was like, God, I should have known in that moment. But as we will find out in a second, it was essential that she didn't. So after she said, did anything inappropriate happen? And he said, they were inappropriate with me. She then followed up with, did you do anything inappropriate to them? And Jim responded, Debbie, please don't ask me that. Please don't ask me that. So I guess the conversation continued and eventually he left. But my mom wasn't like, you know, hey, are you touching my kid? She had no reason to believe that I had been molested. And I hadn't said anything to her, but she knew that something was up. Alarm bells were going off, but she wasn't just going to start accusing people of anything. So eventually Jim left. And I think I told my mom like 4 days later or maybe 3 days later. I mean, I was scared at that point. I don't even know if I was going to say anything to anyone before he came over. But when he came over, it was like, oh, fuck, like this is, you know, I'm not safe here now. I gotta tell somebody about this. So eventually, you know, she sat me down and started asking me questions about what had happened. And eventually she said, did Jim do something? And I said, yes. And she said, did he hurt you? And I said, no. And she said, did he touch you? And I said, yes. And that was the only way that I was able to even find the words to say what had happened, because I still don't really understand it. But I, because of the questions that she asked, I was able to say yes. So my mom and my dad and I are reflecting on this story. And what we started thinking about was like, why did Jim come over that day? What was his goal? I mean, he walked into our house without, why did he walk into the house? Why didn't he wait for us to open the door? And Jim is a lawyer. I don't know if he still is, but he was a lawyer. And he's a smart guy. This is a very, you know, meticulous pedophile who was very aware. And after the trial happened, there were a bunch of articles written about it, and somebody reached out to the detective on the court case saying that Jim had molested him like 20 years ago. So Jim has been molesting kids at least for 20 years and at least two kids. Super unlikely that we are the only ones. But basically, he knows when I left their house in tears, he knows that I am a huge liability now. Because if I go and tell my mom or my dad or anyone about what has happened, he will very likely be charged and have to go to trial for child molestation. He might lose his job, friends, he might lose family, and he might go to jail for a super long time. So my mom and dad and I were trying to think about, like, why did he come over there? And we started realizing, like, he was trying to figure out what was going on. He was trying to get to me, and ideally, from his perspective, I haven't told anyone yet, and he's able to get to me and to either threaten me to try to convince me not to say anything or to beg me to not say anything. Who knows what his plan of attack was? But I think, and we all kind of came to this conclusion, that if he's asking me to not say anything and I'm like, no way, dude, I'm done with this. I'm going to tell my mom or somebody else. It felt like he might have killed me. And if there was a way that he could confirm that I had told my mom and that she hadn't told anyone yet, which he may have thought because when he talked to my dad didn't know anything yet, then maybe he would have killed us both. because if he comes over and he can figure out, okay, Sebastian hasn't said anything yet, then he could probably also infer that I maybe won't say anything. But when he opens the door, he doesn't wait for us to come to the door. He barges into the house. Because if I've told my mom that this guy is a child molester, she's not just going to be like, yeah, come on in. He'll know, based on her reaction, probably, whether or not I've spoken up. So I think he came into the house basically ready for anything. If the situation that did end up playing out was the case, and he was able to infer that my mom didn't know, even though he wasn't able to get to me, he was okay. He was more comfortable because he knows I haven't said anything yet and I probably won't. But if he's able to infer or definitively conclude that my mom knows, and he's able to figure out that either my dad doesn't know, and I should also clarify, he came over in the middle of the day and he knows that my dad works. So he knows that my dad's not there. So if he's able to come over and basically figure out that my mom knows and that she hasn't called the cops yet, then it feels like, hypothetically, he may have tried to kill us. It's kind of like that scene in, if you've seen Barry, the last scene of the first season. Barry is he's a paid assassin. And this detective who's been investigating these murders that have been happening basically figures out, sorry for the spoilers, figures out that Barry is the guy who's been doing it. And she pulls a gun on him and is like, hey, you're going to jail. And Barry starts saying, please don't do this. Please don't do this. In the exact same way that Jim responded to my mom when she asked him, did you do anything inappropriate? Because Barry knows in that moment that he now has to kill the detective. Because she knows. And so I think that he didn't come over hoping or wanting to kill us, but I think he was prepared if the situation presented itself where he was able to conclude that my mom knew and my dad didn't know yet and nobody else did. We don't know definitively that this is what he was going to do or was prepared to do, but in the land of hypotheticals, this is certainly possible. And I had this crazy moment when I started really considering what that would have been like. You know, if I was in my room with my back against my door and I heard Jim and my mom fighting, or I heard a gunshot, what would that be like? It put me into that moment in a way that I'd never been in it before. And, you know, with therapy and all this EMDR that I've been doing, it felt very real. And there was this moment in real life, not that that wasn't real life, but there was this moment when we were sitting around the table and having these realizations where I felt something come up. It was like kind of like just at the base of my neck, just above my sternum. I felt this thing bubble up and I was like, whoa, I don't know what this is. It feels like some sort of emotion that's coming up, but I saw it and there was a moment of hesitation and I was kind of like, I kind of saw the two roads. Like I could easily bury this and act like it was nothing, or I could explore it and see where it goes. And so I let it come up and I just broke down and started bawling. And like right into my mom's arms. And it was like a near-death experience realization. A hypothetical one. But as we know, hypotheticals can feel very real sometimes. And it was this amazing moment where I was able to be with this person who I realized I had almost died with, my mom. And then, you know, my dad was there too, obviously, and just sort of seeing this trajectory that our family could have been on if I had spoken up right away in that car ride back, if my mom had gotten me to speak up sooner. And it was, in my life, the quickest I've ever processed emotion. I think it was the least resistance I've ever had to emotion coming up. And it felt so good to just fucking feel the fuck out of this feeling. and to be safe, you know, with my mom and dad there, knowing how bad it could have been. And I think it was amazing for my mom too, because she was able to, you know, protect me and make me feel safe in this moment now at 27 years old, despite feeling like she let me down when I was 8 to 10. And so it was just this incredible moment, and it felt so significant and purposeful. And what we started realizing as we continued to expand this hypothetical was like the way things happened was the absolute perfect way. You know, I feel now more than ever that this is where I want to be in this moment, in this life situation. And even if I could go back and not be molested, I don't think I would change anything. I don't know what my life path would have been like without it, but I am so happy with the way things turned out. And I'm so happy now, even if I don't have enough likes on Instagram. So if she noticed, if she prevented the whole thing from happening, that wouldn't have been optimal. If she had noticed sooner, I may never have spoken up. I may never have told anyone anything. I may never have healed. The way things happened was so perfect, and she had a hunch in that moment, but she also, you know, like, even though she didn't know that I had been molested when Jim came over, it was essential that she didn't know. And it's the moment that she found out, that's the reaction that matters. It's not blaming yourself for all the things that could have gone differently. What's important is how you reacted when you did know, which was believing me and not even for a second doubting that I was telling the truth. I know so many people who have spoken up and not been believed by their parents, by their friends, you know, whoever, but my parents believed me right away. There was never a thought in my mind that they didn't, and I'm so lucky for that. So when I did tell my mom, I, like I said, made her promise not to tell my dad. And she didn't initially. She talked to one of her friends, and her friend said that she needed to go call this hotline. She needed to report this to the police. And so my mom did that before telling my dad. And my dad, who's also a lawyer, was furious when... Obviously, he was extremely upset about all of this when he first found out about it, because my mom did call him and tell him. But she told my dad after she had reported it. So once it's been reported, they are legally obligated. They have to tell the police. They have to go to court. All this stuff has to happen. But if my mom had just told my dad right away, right after I told her, my dad, who was a prosecuting attorney for many years and knows how traumatizing the trial would be for me and all of us, he was saying in this conversation that he was ready to just move us to England. My mom's English and I have dual citizenship. And he was like, he was ready to go. But it was because my mom reported it that we had to stay. So in another hypothetical trajectory, we move to England and we don't go to trial. I never do stand up. None of this stuff happens. So my mom literally called my dad like right after she had reported it. And that was what caused all of this stuff to happen. So all the things, and my dad was so mad in that moment for being knowing that we had to go to court. And my mom was mad for not knowing that I had been molested earlier. All these things that we were regretting, and I was regretting, you know, how did I not say something sooner the whole time? That was part of why it was so hard to say something, is I thought everyone would say, why didn't you say something sooner? All of these reasons that, in retrospect, in this hypothetical reflection that we were all doing, it was so clear to see that everything that happened was perfect. No matter how traumatizing it was, it got us to now. And now is so good. And it's a really fucking amazing feeling to feel like there is nothing that I would change. There's nothing I would do differently. And this isn't limited to the molestation. This is everything. If you feel that way about molestation, you can certainly extrapolate it to other areas of life too. But it was just, it was so trippy to have these conversations with my parents and to realize, I mean, everything that could have gone wrong didn't. And the timing, when you look at the thread and the way it all evolved, the timing was so, it was like beautiful to see. It was, it, and I felt like there were things that were happening that I felt like protected. I felt like I couldn't make a mistake. Even the things that I perceived as mistakes were just things that I hadn't seen yet why they weren't mistakes. And this is how I feel about everything now. It's like anything that you, we really don't know if anything that happens is good or bad, because we can't comprehend the infinite possible outcomes and ripple effects that any event has. Something that you might perceive as bad today might end up being the thing that causes you to grow in ways that you never would have grown without it, or pursue things and discover things that you love that you wouldn't have discovered probably without it, like the molestation and now podcasting. So you don't know really if anything that happens is bad. And in the same way, you don't know if anything that happens is good for the same reasons, which could be perceived as bad. But you know that you don't know, no matter how hard you try and no matter how sure you are, you don't know if anything that happens is good or bad. So ultimately, you begin to not mind what happens. And it's a really comfortable, powerful feeling to be totally okay with whatever happens. Just trusting that it's best for you and everyone involved, even if you can't see it yet. Even if it takes you 16 years to have these realizations. I mean, my parents and I have been talking about this shit extensively for the last 5 years, and we never had this conclusion, this hypothetical conclusion about what Jim was potentially willing to do in those moments. And it felt like we had this realization in a moment where we were all open. And this is like my first time coming back home after I've been in therapy for the last 3 months. And I felt like really open emotionally. And it felt like I was able to let those emotions come up and release them and just be there with my mom and my dad and not have any sort of resistance to crying or whatever. It just happened so perfectly. And it's still happening. It's always happening. There's never a moment where you haven't been like, you know, these forces or whatever, you, these universal guidances or things that are happening just in unfathomably perfect timing. It just felt like such a clear example of how it's always been going on. You know, I think like with the synchronicities and things that we talk about on this podcast, I don't know if more synchronicities happen as you become more aware of them, but this really made it feel like they've always been happening. Literally on like a primal survival level. Everything in this story that allowed us to survive, it just seems so unlikely that there aren't other things going on. And I just felt so fucking protected and safe in these moments. And I was like, holy shit, I can't make a mistake. What a feeling. Anything that I would perceive as a mistake may be the best thing that's ever happened to me down the line, and I just don't know it yet. And it's funny too, because my therapist and I, we did this, my parents and I had this chat on a Wednesday night, and my therapist and I talked on Thursday morning, and what we were going to do EMDR about was trying to cultivate a sense of safety and trust in the universe. And that's literally how I felt from this conversation with my parents to a T. And I don't know what to a T means. Let me look this up. Why is it to a T? Meaning exactly, precisely, or perfectly, in an older expression than you might think, dating all the way back to the 17th century. Most likely the phrase is descended from the expression to a tittle. A tittle is a small mark used in orthographic details, such as the dot over the I, and the sense is to, quote, to the smallest detail. All right. Well, yeah, to a T. That's how I felt, and it feels amazing. So I was talking with my therapist and we had this amazing conversation about all this stuff that happened, and we didn't do EMDR about those feelings because I just already felt it. I felt so enthusiastic and powerful and safe and just like really, really believing that everything is happening perfectly. which just seems so perfect for this podcast. But it gets crazier. Okay, after the therapy session, I went outside and my dad and I sat at this table that's like, you know, 15 or 20 feet from the table that we were at last night with my, the night before with my mom. And it's right next to this pond. And there's this nice tree overhanging the table. It's like right next to our back porch. And so we're sitting there and my dad goes, oh, you know, I have this app, like, because I looked at this tree. I was like, oh, it's a really nice tree. And he was like, yeah, I have this app, you know, it's a yew tree. And so he pulled up this app, I think it was called Picture This. It's like an app, you point it at a tree or plant and it tells you what it is. So we looked it up and it's a Pacific yew tree. And it is not just poisonous, it is fatally poisonous. Almost every part of the tree is deadly to humans. The leaves, the sap, not just eating, but touching. If you touch the tree, it can be absorbed into your skin and kill you. It's literally called the tree of death. You can look it up. Actually, maybe I'll look it up right now. Yew tree death? Question mark. The Pacific yew, the tree of death or the tree of life, or both. Okay. The yew has a reputation for sudden death in both people and livestock. There are even reports of ancient yews being uprooted with bones intertwined in their roots. Good. So, the yew tree was used for suicide during war times. Even food and drink vessels made from the wood of the yew could poison those who ate from them. All right, so this tree is literally a killing machine, and it's overhanging the table that we sometimes eat food at. I'll pull up a video of it. I'm sitting at a table right outside of my childhood home next to a pond with some fish in it. Literally, you walk. We used to have this chicken coop, and you would walk the pathway from the back porch to the chicken coop was directly next to the yew tree. You walk right by it, and it used to overhang, and you know, it was like we had all these chickens running around, and they seemingly never died from eating the yew leaves or the berries or anything. But I mean, as a kid, like, I was running around and all of my friends were running around the backyard, and like this yew tree was like an absolute centerpiece of the entire yard. Nobody's ever died from it or even been harmed by it. So my dad, just from putting his app up to this tree, realized that this thing could kill us. And we were like, oh my God, this is so insane. We've lived in this house for 24 years and it's never harmed anyone that we know of. And we were thinking like, God, how related is this to all the realizations that we had the night before about this guy who we never perceived as like a threat to our lives? I mean, obviously he was a threat to my dick, but like I never thought he would kill us or anything like that. And then we had all these realizations that, holy shit, that could have been what happened. And here we are sitting next to this tree that could have killed us in any moment in 24 years, and it never did. And, you know, our initial reaction was like, oh man, we gotta get rid of this. We gotta uproot it. We gotta, you know, this is super dangerous. What is going on? This is nuts. How has this not hurt us? And then we thought more about it and it was like, okay, well, if it hasn't hurt anyone in 24 years, it doesn't seem super likely to do it now. And it feels like by uprooting it and all the shedding that would happen, and even if we had it professionally removed, it feels like that would be the type of thing that would cause it as a tree, even though it can't speak, it's a sentient being in some capacity. It's growing. It's filled with the universal energy that we're filled with. It's growing. And it was like another near-death experience, only this near-death experience had been happening like every day for my entire life. This has been going on, apparently. I mean, I used to just walk to the chicken coop to collect the eggs in the morning to make eggs for breakfast as a child. And I don't know how I never touched it. I don't know how any of us never touched it. But this tree is clearly not meaning to harm us. And now we're aware of it. And, you know, it felt so similar to all the realizations that happened the night before and in my therapy session, where it was like, yeah, man, we're protected. As much as we may run into these dangerous beings, you know, there are things going on here that are greater than our understanding. And I mean, this you experience just felt like it just solidified the fuck out of that feeling. And so I think we're going to leave it. Obviously, we're aware of it now and we'll tell anybody that comes over, but I mean, it's remarkable. And to have this realization about this tree, literally like 12 hours after we had this other conversation about this other hypothetical near-death experience. Only this one isn't hypothetical. This is like, I'm a foot away from this tree that could kill me. Also, this tree is used for like a lot of different, like people use this in gardens. People just have yews. But, and it's not even a big deal. My dad said during this conversation that he had an arborist come by when he was, you know, going around trying to figure out what trees he wants to take down, what trees are at risk of falling. You know, he had a professional tree observer come around and tell him which trees would be good to take out. And apparently, the only tree that he commented on as a tree that he liked was the yew. He said, I love yews. It's spelled Y-E-W, but I love you. It's just, that's just too good to be true, you know? But this guy who's aware of trees and knows how dope yews are, because they look sick, but he was like, yeah, man, I know that I'm here to remove trees that are dangerous, but fucking leave that one there for some reason. I mean, I don't know what this guy was thinking, not even telling my dad that it was poisonous. My dad got this tree from a nursery. Why do you have deadly things in a nursery? I know it's a plant nursery, but any nursery. There should be no deadly threats in any nurseries in the world, let alone having them sold to people. How did this happen? This is the type of shit that feels like it's too crazy to not have more things going on. It's too unlikely for us to not be protected in the decisions that we make, in the things that surround us. It's just fucking amazing, dude. It's so dope. And so just literally like 2 or 3 days later, and a bunch of shit happened every single night on this trip. It was like every night was just filled with realizations and memories coming back and recontextualizing trauma, all this powerful healing. And it was the day of the lottery. The lottery was at like $1 billion. And I went to go buy a lottery ticket. And it was like the middle of the day. You know, I'm on vacation. I'm hanging out with my family. I have like, there's no rush. And I get to the store. It's called the Jiffy Mart. I walked in. I asked the cashier where the lottery tickets were. And she pointed me to them. And there was this guy in there who was like really quickly filling out lottery tickets or the numbers on the paper. And I had never like filled out my own before. I didn't know how to do it. And so I grabbed one of the papers and took it to the front and asked the cashier, how do you do this? And she was like, oh, I actually don't know, but I can sell you the numbers via the computer. And I was like, okay, great. Like I'll do, you know, just give me some of those. So I paid for them. And then I went back to put the paper ticket back because I didn't know how to fill it out. And the guy who was filling out the tickets beforehand was standing there and he was like, oh, you don't want this? And I was like, no. And he was like, oh, it's the last one. And I was like, go for it, man. Like you got this, you know? I really, in that moment, like I really wanted him to win. It felt like it obviously really meant a lot to him. And he clearly was really, really happy and excited to have the last lottery ticket to fill out. So I don't know if he won. I spent $12 and won $2, I think. But I bought some things in the Jiffy Mart too. I bought a chocolate milk and some snacks. And after I got the tickets, I went out and I was sitting in the car and I was thinking to myself, God, it feels so good to not be in a rush. Like it just feels, I feel so safe right now. I feel so grateful to be able to just sit in this parking lot and not have to rush off. And I, you know, cracked my chocolate milk. It was one of those bottles. They are so much better than any other type. I was just drinking my chocolate milk and hanging out in the parking lot, feeling good about just being there. And eventually I pulled the car out of the parking lot and was driving, and I was driving like really slowly and just feeling like, God, this is so, it feels so good. It feels really good to take my time. And I'd been driving for like, I don't know, 45 seconds. And I got to this three-way stop. I was in the middle. I was like maybe 20 feet from the stop sign. And this massive truck like swerved. It was coming from my perspective, the left stop sign. And it swerved like way into my lane, going way too fast. It didn't look like it stopped at all at the stop sign. I mean, like 75% of my lane was taken up by this truck, and it swerved out of the way of me and got back into its lane and then kept going. And I was like 2 to 3 seconds from having a head-on collision with this truck. And what was so trippy about it was that my heart rate didn't go up at all. Like, I wasn't surprised by the fact that I had just avoided this potentially fatal car crash. I just kind of kept going, taking my time. And it was directly because I was in this headspace of not needing to rush and feeling good about not having to rush and just enjoying the moment. And it was just another example of this protective force or whatever it is. I mean, I was not surprised. I was expecting to avoid that type of a thing. I wasn't like, I'm going to drive slow so that I don't get in a car crash. But because of this headspace that I was in, where we avoided this near-death experience with Jim, avoided the near-death experiences with the U, I was expecting to be protected. And I was believing that I was protected and feeling so good about it. And then it happened to be this headspace of just taking my fucking time that allowed me to avoid disaster. And, you know, whenever I've come close to any sort of car crash, or, you know, when things like this generally happen, my heart rate is through the roof. And it just felt like I just wasn't surprised. And I am very grateful and lucky that I took my time in that drive back.
I may have lost $10 on those tickets, but it certainly felt like I won the lottery in that moment. And in this moment. In every moment. Like, we just, the life lottery. We all won the life lottery. And we're experiencing it currently. Like, how lucky we all are.
It made me think about, like, the power of expectation and the power of belief and the power of gratitude and the power of not rushing. Of just trusting that everything's working out for you and that there's nowhere that you think you need to be that could be more important than where you are right now. It was just so dope. And it feels good. It feels good to be alive. It feels good to be able to talk about this stuff on this podcast. And I'm so grateful for you listening. What a trip. I'll get into the other stories of this trip home on another episode. Seems like a reasonable stopping point for this one. So thank you for listening. You are protected. You're safe. The protection doesn't go away. Just going to keep feeling that way. Yeah. Yeah, dude. All right. I'll see you guys later. Peace.